Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
And gentlemen, let's get ready to be inspired! Introducing in the red corner, American Tennis! And introducing in the blue corner, your host for American Tennis, Mr. Chuck Greasy! Ladies and gentlemen, time to get in the game.
And good morning once again. This is Coach Chuck Creasy, and it's another week of American Tennis every week on the UR Tennis Network. That's the letter U, the letter S Network. If you want to be a person who calls in today, a caller, call area code 714-583-6853. That's 714-583-6853, and you can talk to our guest. Every week on American Tennis, we remind you of the mission is to stand up and to speak out and to say those things you need to say, and we just always ask you to address issues, not people, and nobody can find fault with that. Just stay professional with everything to us. Every week on the UR Tennis Network, we have a different program. On Monday, we have Lisa Stone, which is Parenting Aces. She's every Monday at noon. Recently, her topics have had a lot to do with college tennis and what is going on with the mandate that the ITA is on. That's the College Connection program. The American Tennis Program. I'm Chuck Creasy. My website is chuckcreasy.net, K-R-I-E-S-E. You can find out about my camps, my books, my blog, and you can get every American Tennis Program over the past 2 years. Things are in New York right now and broadcast from the U.S. Open, and I'm got Lawrence on right now. Lawrence, are you on the line?
Yeah, can you hear me?
I sure can, Lawrence. Coming in very, very well. Folks, this is Lawrence Clager. And Lawrence right now, Lawrence, coach's dream. I mean, you're a youngster. If you ask any kid in the United States, you'd rather be ranked number one in the United States or win Kalamazoo, they're going to say I'd rather win Kalamazoo. If you ask any kid in the world, you'd rather be ranked number one in the world or to win Wimbledon, they'd say I'd like to win Wimbledon, and these two titles are the two most heralded junior titles in the world, and your player Noah Rubin won singles at Wimbledon, and singles at Kalamazoo. Also won the doubles at Kalamazoo. I didn't check out the doubles at Wimbledon. How's he doing doubles over there, Lawrence?
He didn't play doubles in Wimbledon. He wanted to concentrate on singles. He's, by his own admission, not the world's greatest doubles player, which is, makes Kalamazoo doubles that much more shocking. But, you know, he wanted to concentrate on singles there. But at Kalamazoo, obviously, you know, winning the doubles title or the singles title is very prestigious and is certainly an honor. It puts him right up there with some of the game's greats. So he figured he would take a shot at both of those. And the fact that he won both is just amazing.
Well, you know, as a coach, it's such a selfless job for sure. I mean, basically, you're a teacher first, coach second, and you basically have to take care of so many different things. And we sure want to talk with you about all the aspects of those things today. But, again, with the wins that he's had, he gets straight in main draw of the U.S. Open men's and singles and U.S. Open men's and doubles. What I love is they still play the 3 out of 5. Sets the finals, and I just, in this age where they're abbreviating all the matches, I just so happy that they do that. I heard David Markin, before he passed away 10 years ago, said, look, we have to continue to do that because basically taking a spot as a wild card away from some journeyman has been out there maybe for 10 years trying, and our kids have to earn it the hard way. So I just want to throw those. Let me just real quick, Lawrence, tell the people about you a little bit. I mean, right now you've got to be as happy as anybody with what your student has done. You've had Noah since 7 years old, is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. I started him when he was 7.
Hello?
Can you hear me, Chuck?
Yeah, I can hear you. Since 7 years old, is that correct? You've had him since 7 years old?
Correct. Yeah, we started when he was about 7. His dad brought him to me. His dad was a pretty good tennis player. I think he played in high school or whatever. Not a great player, but a good player. And, you know, he really loved the sport, and he wanted to give it to his son. And, you know, I said at the time, it's the best job I've ever seen of a tennis parent working with their own child. So when I got him, he was actually pretty good. So, you know, it was kind of refreshing to see that.
Start out there. I mean, before he came to you, what did the father do or the parents do to move his skills along, you know, at level?
Well, I would say the most important thing that his dad did was sort of really instill the love of the sport. The day I met Noah, I trying to make conversation, I said, what's your favorite thing to do? And I thought he'd say, you know, go to the mall with my friends, you know, I don't know what, but watch a movie. And he said, play tennis with my dad. And, you know, when you look at tennis at any indoor facility and a parent walks in with a child, most of the tennis pros get together and they have a pool. They, you know, kind of figure how long is it going to take for that parent to start screaming at the kid and the kid to come off crying. And usually that's about 11 minutes. So the fact that Noah's favorite thing to do was play tennis with his dad really said something pretty special about his dad.
It really is amazing. And what you say there, we say it, and we all do as coaches, but it really is true. Usually parents try to force their kids into it, and then the kids sort of are compliant for a while, and then they break down one way or another and try to find you know, other things to do. But that job of parenting, you know, our children want to do things with us. I'm trying that right now, Lawrence, to try to coax my 10, 8, and 6-year-old into tennis. And, you know, for sure, I think that it's a better way that you're talking about. Lawrence, you're the executive director of tennis there at Sporttime Academy, so Rose Academies. And, you know, you're known as one of the top developmental coaches in the country already. I mean, you're known for your wisdom. You're known for being able to hire very people and contribute for the good of what's going on there. And I wanted to add, New York, my God, I mean, what a competitive place. I mean, just to get kids to play, but to deal with the parents, and then you've got these hugely competitive kids, I guess, just because of the structure. But talk about that a little bit, about trying to create a tennis training center in New York, and you actually are managing three of them at the same time. So talk a little bit about that, if you could.
Well, first, thank you for those comments, and then certainly it's an honor for me to be on with a true tennis legend. Any of my accomplishments seem to pale next to yours, so I appreciate the compliment. New York is a very tough place. It's very competitive. I always tell pros that call for jobs, if you can't, if you don't have a personality and you can't move real fast, if you can't think fast, New York's not the place to be, because you'll get chewed up and spit out. But if you're good at what you do and you have confidence and you care about tennis and you actually care about your students, then this is the best place, in my opinion, to be. New Yorkers are demanding. They're sometimes very tough, but they're very loyal. So when you do a good job and you perform well, they're very appreciative, very loyal, and it's a very good situation. And that's kind of what we try to do. We really try to be on the high end of not only the instruction, but also the customer service, keeping parents involved, explaining to parents what's going on, having them involved in the process, because if the parents aren't involved, it's usually difficult, because at some point in time, someone's going to grab their ear and say, how come your kid's number 11? If they were playing in my club, they'd be number 3. So if you don't sort of stay in contact, if parents aren't somewhat involved, to me, that's a problem. But, obviously over-involvement is another issue. But usually if you manage those relationships properly between the player, the coach, and the parent, it usually works out pretty well. In terms of the competitiveness, yeah, there's so many clubs around where we are. There's so many clubs that are owned by individual operators, and those operators can just decide to undercut, somebody price-wise. So, you're always fighting for the better players. You're fighting for the recreational players. you're always fighting, and to me, that fight is a good one. It means that you're held to a high standard of delivering the product that you think should be out there and that people want. So I'm a very competitive person, so sometimes the competition gets a little tough, but I kind of like it. I kind of like trying to be the best, and I think our results so far demonstrate that at least we're certainly, up or near the top of those clubs.
There's nobody.
Chuck, can you hear me?
They compete as bellhops. They compete and just walk. Everything is competition. And, my years as a college. About getting a steering wheel sometimes, it's about, having a big engine, but it's also about having the steering wheel. I wonder about this. Level 2, one time, okay, privileged enough back 1981, 80, somewhere in there, I was able to sit for a couple hours on a panel one time with Arthur Ashe. And back then, and I remember the question somebody asked him, he says, where are we losing our kids? And his comment was level 2. He says, we get the hook in their mouth, but it doesn't stay. He says, we introduce the kids to the game, but then they don't stay with it. When it starts to get hard and when they start to then lose a lot, that's when we lose them. And how about you to win or when they start to want to win, but guess what? I got to lose a lot in tennis. Hello?
Yeah. Kind of coming in and out. I don't know if we have a bad connection, but I think what you were talking about is, the kids, a lot of kids sort of enter the sport, try the sport, but then they leave the sport.
Right.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons in the past, when I first started coaching, you know, there was this idea that tennis was a sport that there's so many skill elements to it that you had to learn those skills before you could actually play tennis. And, almost like, okay, we're going to learn a forehand. As soon as you get that down, we'll try backhand. And maybe in another year or two, you'll be able to play a match. And I think, you know, in those days back then, kids weren't their lives weren't as fast as they are now. You know, their lives were in sound bites, you know. So parents could go, okay, yeah, all right, we'll wait. You know, but nowadays kids want to play. They don't want to learn as much as they want to play. And if they enjoy playing, well, then they're willing to learn. So I think that the whole way I think tennis is being taught now is a whole lot better and smarter. And I think because of that, we'll have a much better chance of keeping them in the sport. We lose a lot of players because of finances. That's a problem. We lose players, of course, to other sports. In our country, tennis is not, an elite sport compared to football, basketball, baseball, hockey, whatever. So, you know, it's kind of tough. You know, we're kind of fighting for elite athletes, and they're hard to come by in our country that are sort of willing and able to play tennis right now. So I guess the more that tennis becomes financially accessible to maybe lower-income families, the broader the pool of athletes will be to play our sport. So right now you might have three elite athletes in a high school, and one plays basketball, one plays baseball, one plays football. Chances are neither of the three are playing tennis. So again, that to me is a big challenge for us. Keeping kids in the game is really the issue. Some of the stats that have come out about players dropping out are really scary. So I think we all have to do a better job of really making sure that we have our finger on the pulse and sort of get a sense of when those players are leaving and why they're leaving and what can we do about it to keep them in.
I'd sure encourage everybody to go to your website, Sporttime. I think it's Sporttime Tennis, sporttimenewyork.com. It's the GAMTA blog that you wrote. You wrote about six or seven very impacting paragraphs there on the importance of the technical, tactical, and then the extra play. And I think you described this, that it's all not just about the technical part of it. So you approach it from the standpoint of getting kids, into the competition and playing too as well, not just the technical aspects. Kids get turned off if you just do that, right? Did I get into blog site and everything there? What's that, your website?
Our website is www.sporttime, SPORTIME, the letters NY like New York, .com. And on the website, there's a little button that says a word from our director, and that's the piece that you're talking about. And when I first started coaching, I was all technical. Tactical was kind of like, I figured you learn that yourself when you play. But over the years, I've realized the error in those ways. And I think now the most important thing to me is that balance, is kind of marrying the tactics to the technical. But if it's, if everything is brought back to the technical, then you're basically saying that our sport is only about skill development and about form, that it's almost like figure skating. You know, tennis is a sport like basketball and baseball. There's a ball, there's time and space, there's a lot of thinking, strategizing, employing tactics. It's a very difficult sport, and to sort of bring everything back to a technical flaw, to me, really sort of stifles the growth of a player, and also, makes it really, really hard for them to focus on the things that they really need to be focusing on when they're playing a match. So, you know, we certainly understand, you know, the necessity to have technical proficiency, but I think we go about it in a slightly different way. That, you know, we don't want our kids to be good lesson takers and good ball strikers. We want them to be, you know, great tennis players, and that's what we try to do.
And then, Pete, with that, now you started out as a basketball player, didn't you? Didn't you play in college a little bit, and you grew up basketball? The way you go into the tennis teaching too.
Well, you know, again, I played my freshman year in college. You know, I was in those days, you know, there was a freshman team and a varsity team, and I was on the freshman team, and one of the coaches came up to me and said, you know, listen, you're doing really well out here. And I said, thank you. And he said, well, but you're not going to play at all. So do you want to stay on the team? And, you know, I said, I guess not. But so I didn't have an illustrious basketball career, but I was a basketball nut. You know, that's all I wanted to do as a kid. And, you know, when my basketball career came to an abrupt halt, you know, deservedly so, you know, I didn't have anything athletic to do. And so that's how I kind of got interested in tennis. But the basketball kind of, I always felt that basketball was a very good cross-training sport for tennis. You know, about the, you know, speed and agility, about quickness, about, you know, change of direction, you know, about, you know, what do you have to do to sort of steal a ball? What do you have to do to get into a passing lane? You know, it's almost like what you do when you play the net. There's a lot of crossover, I think, to the sports. So I think it was understandable that I liked tennis because I liked basketball.
You know, you approached the athlete point of view first. I mean, that has to have helped your teaching. I mean, and then I know you, and you're very detail oriented as well. You see what other people don't see, and you have an eye to see the unseen by most. But then you have that background in basketball, so you know how to compete, and you obviously on to your youngsters. You feel like this. I mean, that has to be a big part of it. How do you do that in a training center situation where you have a bunch of kids? Court time is very expensive. You've got all these competitive teams. I mean, talk about, like, when your kids come in, you know, they come twice a week, and how do you formulate the competition in there with the technical aspects and everything else?
Well, what we do is we do a lot of what we call tactical games with our players. In other words, we put them in situations where the rules of the game are such that they have to try to employ a tactic. If they don't do it, then they can't possibly win the point. So it's not like we just send them out there and say, okay, play some points and we'll see who wins. You know, I probably know who's going to win before they go out there. So, you know, what happens is they're practicing, you know, a tactic over and over again. So they're getting really good at that tactic. But they're also competing. They're also trying to, you know, win on their court, and if they win on their court, they get to move up a court. So we try to build in the competitiveness that way. So I'd say three-quarters of their time is actually spent in competition, not such hostile competition where, you know, it's life or death, but, you know, it's such that they're trying to do a particular task, but they're also trying to do it better than the other people on the court. And while that's happening, our coaches are being very, very supportive of what they're doing. It's a very positive, encouraging type program. If we see that someone is having problem with any kind of technical issue, we have program directors that go court to court, and if they spot something, they can just sort of take that player out of the line. We could put them on video, show them their stroke, sort of show them what their flaw is, and then, you know, have them work on that and then put them back into the game and sort of do our technical that way in the groups. But also, you know, our kids are encouraged to take private lessons. That's a time when a coach can really delve into technical issues and really sort of address them one-on-one. So, again, it's not like we don't recognize the importance of technical, and it's not like we think that technical is really not important or secondary. But we try to such infuse it rather than shove it down their throats.
Lawrence?
Yep, can
Lawrence,
you hear me?
This coach, yep, I watch it has to be. I'm in a bad place at the Open, so I'm sorry if I think probably everybody got part of your statement there about getting the kids to compete. So I'm hoping I found a place here we won't lose again. But if we do lose, you can stay on the line again, okay?
Okay, if I lose you, I'll just dial back. Is that the best?
You're not sure. I'm coming forward here. All right, I know when we go to a commercial in a few minutes, I want to come back and talk basically about Noah and some of the things you've done with him. And about the training, because this is an important thing. When parents bring their kids, there's two things that really hit home here. The first thing is that, you know, doggone it, the sport is tough, and you're going to lose a lot, so you've got to teach the kids to start competing right away. You know, the other thing is that the balance between the technical, the tactical, and the competition are critical. And, you know, then you have to have the involvement of the parents for sure. I bet you have some unbelievable stories in New York and stuff. But what do you do? I mean, you know, the kid usually is never to blame, but how do you deal with the parents? Do you have parent seminars? Do you have, any special things there that you
yeah.
do with parents?
Yeah, well, we do have parent seminars. Unfortunately, they're not heavily attended. But, you know, we certainly try to do that. And we try to, you know, reach out to parents and try to, you know, explain everything to them. You know, again, someone watching a program for the first time, you know, if they're used to a different kind of program, you know, their first reaction is, oh, this isn't what I'm used to. You know, what are they doing out there? So many times we have to explain to parents, you know, what we're doing, why we're doing it. And usually after that happens, you know, they get it, and we don't have any problems. It's usually the difference between, in my opinion, the way tennis is taught now versus maybe the way tennis was taught when these parents were kids, you know, when they were taking lessons. So, you know, some parents say, well, we never did this when I was a kid. I go, yeah, I didn't do that either. But, you know, the game has changed. So the more communication that we can have with parents, the better off we are, because then they sort of get, you know, the system and understand the what and why of what we're doing.
And that's such a big part of it, because it's a complete investment. Once the kids get to that level two, I agree. And one time I said, if we don't do level two right, we're basically creating bowling. I mean, everybody's been bowling a couple times. Everybody's bowled, but not many people are bowlers. And if there are bowlers out there, folks, I apologize. It's like all
yeah.
of us have gone fishing, but not many of us are fishermen. You know,
right.
So, you know, the thing is to get people who play tennis to be tennis players, and it sounds like you're well on your way. I wanted to ask you one more question before commercial, and that's about a tennis academy. J.P. Weber, We Coach Tennis Program, yesterday was pretty interesting at noon. He talked a lot about the academies in Florida or somewhere, Texas or somewhere, California, where you send your kids off versus to homegrown training centers like you have versus your local pro and doing it on your own. And it seems to me you probably have the best of both worlds, because you probably don't – do you have anybody from outside of New York area, or just New York's enough?
Yeah, well, we're pretty much our students are made up of kids from obviously New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, but not too many people from other states and other countries. Although we have had inquiries, many inquiries, but they, you know, we have to tell them we don't have boarding facilities. So there's been a couple of occasions over the last couple of years where we had actually players sort of come to New York and sort of live with a family or live with a relative and spend time at the academy. But again, we're pretty much homegrown, and you know, that's John's mission, is to sort of have the next great, you know, player be from New York. So,
well, you know, the thing is, he trained at Port Washington Tennis Academy. Of course, that was sort of the model, I guess, because you had the training center in Port Washington, New York. Harry Hobman ran it at the time, with the millions of people in the immediate area, and you could keep your roots from home and your and the formula that only a family can provide, and then you got world-class training at the same time, and maybe that's the model. Talk about the pluses or minuses. I mean, I know probably there was a time where Noah maybe thought about going down to Florida or Texas or something, or was that ever in the picture, or, you know, and how did you talk to him about it?
Well, you know, it came up. I mean, the USTA, when he was 11, I think, offered him, you know, a full scholarship to come down and live in Boca. And, you know, not his dad didn't want him to go, to be separated from him, and certainly Noah didn't want to go to be separated from me. So he decided to stay and didn't go. But, you know, again, I would say, you know, I wouldn't say that I'm sort of slamming, you know, sort of Florida academies by saying, you know, we just do it a little differently here. There's many players that have gone to academies, you know, in warm climates, and because they did that, they became much better players. So I think we're an alternative to kids in New York, that they don't have to leave their families, that they don't have to go to a warm weather climate to get good instruction. So, you know, that's sort of where we fit. The challenges that we have are kind of, you know, being in the north, most of our season is indoors. So players aren't playing outdoors nearly as much as maybe kids in the warmer climates. Court time is very precious in New York. It's very expensive. So that's certainly another challenge.
And every ball you hit is very precious, though, too. I mean, aren't your kids more – I mean, they're pretty daggone locked in when the court time's so precious.
Well, yeah, that's just it. My system is, like, once that bell goes off, you know, at the hour, it's 2 hours of nonstop, you know, movement. You know, there's no kind of sitting around twirling your rackets. It's like time on task for 2 hours. So, because, again, we don't have a lot of time, so we have to make our time, you know, really of the highest quality. You know, the other thing is that the school systems here in New York are very, very, you know, strong. It's a very high academic environment, and school usually runs, you know, from early in the morning to, you know, could be 4 o'clock in the afternoon. By the time kids get home, it doesn't give them a whole lot of time for an activity that requires so much time, like tennis. So, and not only that, is in those schools, their workload is incredible. So, you know, we have that sort of challenge to overcome. But by the same token, you know, we think that we have, you know, a great staff. We think we have a great curriculum. We think there's enough good players for kids to play against. So, you know, we're not complaining. we're just working hard.
Well, you know, now this topic brings up a subject. So Noah goes off to college, going off to Wake Forest here. In the fall, and he'll be a freshman there, and regardless of how long he stays, he's going off and he'll have a college coach, and then, I mean, he looks like he's dead set on a good pro career, and I want to make a couple comments, what I saw when I saw him play, that he things he does other kids can't do, but what do you plan to do now? I mean, obviously, you've been with him since he's 7. I mean, you've got this relationship. I mean, are you going to be like a long-term, long-distance coach some? Go when you can? What are your plans?
Well, you know, we're going to see. So we're taking step by step, and that's kind of how we've done his whole career. You know, we plan his tournament schedule, you know, well in advance. We plan his, you know, I plan his workouts and stuff, you know, in advance. But, you know, things change and things come up and, you know, sometimes I look in his eyes and I change the schedule. So I'm not really thinking that far in advance. He's obviously going to play this year at Wake Forest. He's going to play some professional events in the fall that Tony Bresky will take him to, who's a coach at Wake. he'll play the spring season, and then we'll see. We'll make an assessment of where he's at and what he wants to do. I can predict that he's going to want to leave school and play professional tennis. That's his dream. And if he does, then I will be anywhere from, you know, like you say, maybe, you know, the long distance coach that, you know, he comes back to and trains with. But chances are I'll probably have to have one of my coaches travel with him because I don't have enough time to just travel a full tournament schedule with him.
Thing. So would there be a point where you would go with only him, or?
I didn't hear the first part of that, but I heard the last part. Was would there be a point where I'd only go with him? And the answer to that is no.
Right.
I love teaching, and I love the developmental aspects of it too much to sort of just go with one player. You know, the finances of it, you know, wouldn't change either. I mean, when you love what you do, it's too hard to give it up. My
not
wife so wants me to retire, and so, you know.
Yeah, it's not so good for the family. We're going to go to a commercial. We'll be right back. We're going to hear the whole story about his development. But, folks, this is American Tennis. We have Lawrence Klager on the phone. Hang on. We'll be right back.
This is Coach J.P. Weber of the We Coach Tennis Radio Show. In my 30 years experience in coaching tennis, I've never seen a better tennis training situation for children than Coach Creasy's Total Tennis Training Camps. Chuck Creasy has coached them and trained them in every arena from juniors to collegiate to professional tennis, and over 15,000 children have improved their games at his summer tennis camps. Find out more at ChuckCreasy.net. That's ChuckCreasy.net.
With American Tennis, we have Lawrence Klager. Just the hottest player. You can be hot to Lawrence. Must have played the last couple times. Hello? Yeah, I lost Lawrence here for a second. Well, he'll be calling back in here in a second. And I apologize. We just got a tough at the US Open today. I hope he calls back. I'm sure when the entire story of him grooming really what is our nation's best player right now in the country. A couple things while we got a minute here with what's going on.
Hello?
Hey, Lawrence.
Can you hear me, Chuck?
Thanks for calling, Mike. We got it going here. To find a place here in W.
Yeah, you're breaking up.
How am I doing now? Better?
Better.
Lawrence? Okay, good. I was talking about Noah's style there and how the tempo is so good. He just basically gets ahead in the rallies. The other kids can't quite keep up with the tempo he plays at. Is this a thing you taught him? Am I hitting it right when I sort of look at his game and analyze it?
Yeah, I mean, Noah, when he first started playing, he was like 100% an offensive player. He would like stay on the baseline and just take balls early and just annihilate the ball against like bigger, stronger kids. And, you know, he really started developing his offensive skills actually much more advanced than his defensive skills. And then when he started playing like up in age groups and he was playing bigger, stronger kids, you know, at a higher level, you know, he found himself on defense a lot more. And he really developed his defensive skills really, really well. So, you know, for a while he was like almost in a dilemma, you know, am I playing, you know, am I a counterpuncher or am I an aggressive baseliner or, you know, what am I doing? And I think, you know, the answer to that was that, you know, he perfected both of those things, or not perfected them, but certainly improved at both of those aspects, the defensive and the offensive, to where he's able to apply either depending on the situation. When he played the finals at Kalamazoo, he felt like he had to dictate against Colin Altamirano. Colin has big, heavy strokes and could really push you around, and he just stayed up and didn't let him do that, pretty much controlled, as you say, the tempo of the match. And, you know, he's got that ability. When people ask me, like, how are you designing his game, I tell them I want him to be a combination of David Ferrer and Marcelo Rios. You know, David Ferrer is an incredibly tough competitor, doesn't give you anything, competes every point, great defensively. And Marcelo Rios, in my opinion, although not very well liked on the Pro Tour, was to me close to a genius in terms of being not that big but staying close to the baseline and just redirecting other players' pace and controlling play, almost making it look easy. So that's our blueprint. At 5'9", we can't model his game after John Isner. So we have to be a little more humble.
And basketball, of course, you folks who don't know, that's a swim. Trying again here. Lawrence, I think you might have been caught. Did you call back on a different line here? Lawrence?
Yeah.
I lost you again. Gosh, it's okay. Anyhow, my apologies, and we'll try to pick up here. We're talking about Noah and not being a tweener. And it's really interesting what you said. So when he was younger, he developed his offensive skills and he learned how to attack. But then you said when the kids got a little bit bigger than him, he had to learn how to counterpunch, correct?
Yeah, that's pretty much the case. I mean, personally, I think I'm a very offensive-minded coach. I like weapon development. I find that really interesting and challenging, and I think kids actually like it when they're young. They like to hit. So when kids like to hit, I let them hit. And if they miss, you know, I say it's okay. You know, try again. Take another crack. And, you know, anytime you learn a skill and you practice it enough, you're going to get better at it. You're going to get more accurate, more consistent at it. So, you know, that's kind of how I coach. So when he started, he was very, very offensive. And later on, actually developed the defense, which is, I guess, sort of the reverse of most.
Yeah, that's really interesting because he absolutely has to have both. If you're small and a counterpuncher only, you're limited. A lot of times small guys who try to be big guys end up to be tweeners. So just as important, I would think, is when other kids started knocking him around on the court because of his size, he picked up the counterpunching as well. And it's really quite interesting to see him. That's sort of like, you know, Agassi, right? Agassi was, you know, great offensively from the start, but he became a good counter, great counterpuncher too with his returns and everything. So it's going to be interesting watching him. I want to go back, though, back to 7, 8, 9, 10 in there when you were developing him. And tell me when you knew that he was special as far as, you know, where he was going to go with his game.
Well, you know, maybe I'm a bad judge of talent, but, you know, to be honest, I didn't really know that he was special, you know, special like he is until maybe 14 or 15. You know, he was always very good, but, you know, being very good and being the number one player in your section and, you know, being one of the better players, you know, in the country at age 12 or 13 or whatever. You know, I've seen many players like that and never have pro careers, you know, great 12 and under players, and you never heard of them, you know, never heard from them, you know, on the tour. So, you know, I just kept trying to make him the best player he could be. And he had a breakout tournament. It was in, I think, May or June. He was, I think, just turned 14 or maybe he was 15. He played in an 18 and under national open in Pennsylvania, and it was actually a really, really strong field of kids. And you know, I said to his dad, I said, you know, I don't think there's anybody in this draw that can't beat him. You know, I wouldn't make him a favorite over anybody in the draw. It was 32 kids, and I said every one of these kids could beat him. So it might be a quick tournament. And he played, I think, a seed in the first round and beat him. And I was like in shock, you know, big, strong kid. And every day I'd get you know, the phone call. I wasn't at the tournament. I'd get the phone call. He won. I go, he won. You know, I thought he was kidding. And he ended up winning that tournament. And that's when I knew that he had something special, because what he always did well is every time we played him up, either up an age group or he played up a level, you know, he sort of saw that level and was able to compete at that level almost instantly. You know, the same thing happened when he played his first ITF tournament. We put him in it just because it was in the U.S. and, you know, relatively close by, and we thought that, you know, maybe, you know, he would get some experience. He would look at the players and say, okay, I got it. I see what they're doing. Got to the finals of his first ITF. So, you know, he always kind of had that ability to sort of elevate. But to answer the question, I didn't see it when he was 7, 8, or 9, or 10. That's for sure.
You bring up a big point here. I've always had this saying, it's not what you eat, it's what you digest. You see kids get big wins all the time, but then they get off the bus. It's like they get their comfort level and don't go forward, or they throw it right away. They're just not comfortable with it. And you said that when he got these wins at 14 and 18 tournament, and then also the other time when he played up, he digested the wins and was able to assimilate that level. Is there anything, this is a huge point, and I'd love to answer myself, is there anything that you see that allows him to do that? Is it the security he has in the home? Is it just the way he is? Is it other sports? Anything you can put your finger on?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, and I have an answer, and the answer is, you know, Noah is the most confident player that I've ever had. I've had very confident players, kids that were confident in their own life away from tennis, confident in tennis. But he's the only one that I think has absolute total belief. When he walks on the court, every time he walks on the court, he thinks he's going to win. He doesn't say he's going to win. You know, he doesn't pretend like he's going to win. He actually thinks he's going to win. And I say this all the time, that if he played Nadal, as a matter of fact, he's playing Djokovic tomorrow night in our exhibition here. And he's not taking it. He's not saying like, you know, I hope I don't get beat or whatever. I hope I don't get embarrassed. He's preparing for that match like it's any other match. And if he loses, he's going to be upset. And I know that sounds strange. And 2 days later, he's going to have perfect perspective on it, that he lost to the number one player in the world. But before it and during it, you know, he's going to compete. He's going to think he's going to win. And the other thing that I think that I was able to do with Noah is, and this might be interesting, you know, Noah is notorious for, like, never winning a practice match. He every time he played a practice match, we had something that he was supposed to work on. So when he played that match, he played the match. He tried to win, but he was working on his game. And so when you're working on your game, sometimes, you know, that either distracts you or it doesn't allow you to do the things you do best, because maybe the thing you're working on is something that you don't do well. But he never couldn't care less if he won a practice set. And the story is that he used to play one practice set a week when he was coming up, just one a week. And that would be against a kid on Friday. And he lost about 30 straight sets to that kid and then played him in a tournament for the first time and beat him 1-1 and then proceeded to lose another 20 sets to him. So from the standpoint of the way he – well, sort of to answer your question of – how he can go to a tournament and sort of see the level and kind of learn from it. You know, I think that's how he's been his whole career. He's very open to learning, you know. Yeah.
But you know, with him it sounds like association breeds assimilation. Whoever he hangs around with, he becomes, he assimilates very, very quickly. You know, and I mean, it's ability, desire, opportunity. You know, people... the geneticists might say, hey, it's all ability. Psychologists say it's no desire. Sociologists say it's opportunity. Everybody thinks it's all three of those, or one of those three, but it's really all three. It sounds like his folks did a really good job. Sounds like he has some really good, well, he does have good hand-eye coordination and great speed and a great feel for the game. He's got the X factor and the ABC fundamentals, which is tough to get all of those with players. But, you know, we're always looking for the answer, what makes somebody a little bit different. But, you know, it is that quality that he digests what he eats. He goes forward. He doesn't go backwards. And the confidence, I mean, can you put it, well, how would you define confidence to people listening? What would you say confidence is, or is it, you know, why?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think that confidence comes about in a lot of different ways for different people, but it might show itself pretty much the same way. But, you know, Noah's tennis has been totally positive. In other words, I consider myself a positive coach. I'm not, you know, a command-type coach. I don't, you know, bark and scream and you know, sort of tell players they're worthless, useless. You know, I kind of believe in encouragement and challenge, okay, in terms of kind of the relationship, convincing them that, you know, that I believe in them. So those are the things that I try to provide. And I think that that in that way, you know, you certainly make it a lot easier for someone to be confident. But confidence, I think, comes also from success and from hard work. I think that, you know, Noah always felt like he was working hard, and I would always commend him for working hard. And you know, when you work hard, you feel you're entitled to win, and they kind of go together. And you win, and then you're confident. And, you know,
you're
working hard.
You have ownership.
Yeah.
I often tell kids you're renting your tennis game. You don't really own it. You know, you have to get to a place where you stop renting. And actually own. So
yeah,
the hard work.
Yeah. Yeah, he works hard, and you know he's battled through a lot of matches. That he was had no right to win, and he somehow found a way, and that helps. And the other thing is, in his family life, it's almost the opposite. His family life was very turbulent. His parents had a divorce, or are divorced. It was not a very friendly one, and he's kind of been torn. By that, but he actually has used that to motivate him. He's kind of overcome that and gotten past it, and almost uses it to his advantage. He sort of recognized what it was and understood the situation and dealt with it. And I think that's another sort of feather in his cap that he was able to come through that so well. So. I think there's a lot of things going on in him that sort of allow him to be confident and allow him to believe. So, I don't know if there's a pill that you take, but it seems like you took it. But it's a lot of factors.
Well, there's a saying: it's more important what happens in you than what happens to you. I think we become victims to. Hey, this happened to me, and that happened to me, and this happened to me. But I heard a preacher say that one week. He says, more important what happens in us than what happens to us. You take everything, good goods, and then when something's bad, you make it a good bad. You say, this is good because. But it sounds like this is what he does. And we got about 2 minutes. I absolutely just any other quick thoughts. What's his plans? He'd be at the U.S. Open. No, the draw hadn't been made yet, so you don't know who he's playing first round or anything, do you?
No, the draw comes out tomorrow afternoon. So, we're looking for, in case you're interested, and we're looking for maybe a South American clay court player who doesn't like hard court and doesn't like to be in New York and wants to get out nice and early. So that's what we're pulling for.
Well, we'll see who he draws. It's going to be exciting, Lawrence. And listen, everybody, try to follow Lawrence. Go to the blog. I really enjoyed that today at sporttimenynewyork.com and read Lawrence's blog there. And it was quite interesting about how to combine all this. And Lawrence, you're in the truest sense a teacher first, a coach and a tennis person, but also absolutely just thanks for the work you do with these young people. It's been a great to have you on. I hope you'll come on again. Okay.
Yeah,
Lawrence Clark.
Chuck, thanks so
thanks
much.
Very much. All right.
Made in America, born in a heartland, raised up a family, a King James and Uncle Sam. He got the red, white, blue, fine high on a farm. Semper Fi tattoo. Spend a little more in the store for a tag in the back of this USA. Won't buy nothing that he can't fix. With WD-40 and a Craftsman wrench, he ain't prejudiced. He's just made in America.
Coach Chuck Creasy reminding you that you are in the process of winning or losing every day of your life, and it has very little to do with a win or a loss. Folks, let's watch Noah Rubin. Lawrence Clegg there. You'll see him sitting up in the stands, very proud coach who started this player at 7 years old and got him number one in the United States, really number one in the world probably right now as he won the two biggest tournaments of the year. And God bless all the players, and God bless you guys, and we'll see you next week on American Tennis.
Opinions stated by various contributors to the UR Tennis Network and its programming are not to be considered as endorsed by the UR Tennis Network. Participants are encouraged to use their own discernments and draw their own conclusions. All information, products, and services offered by the UR Tennis Network are for personal use only. The UR Tennis Network does not confirm nor deny the validity or accuracy of information contained within the network. Any products or services provided for should be used solely for entertainment purposes. We emphasize the idea of keeping an open mind and not construing the products, services, or data as factual.